Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on Soundbites, we look at farmers markets in Maryland and beyond. I'll talk with Allison Hope Alcon, professor of sociology at the University of the Pacific, who wrote the book Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. We'll also hear from Ann Palmer, the Eating for the Future program director, the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. And finally, culinary historian Michael Twitty will give us a unique, fascinating, and delicious Passover recipe that fuses African-American and Jewish traditions. But first, we're going to hear from Guy Alston, a shopper at the 32nd Street Farmers Market, about why he shops there.
I got into the farmers market stuff back in the 80s when my father used to have me drive him down to the one that comes under I-83 downtown. But that's only there like 4 or 5 months out of the year. And I hadn't been in quite a while, and I wanted to get some buffalo meat. And I was online, and I saw that these guys back here, the gunpowder guys, actually were at the farmers market down there, which then led to this one because, you know, after December 24th, they don't come back downtown. And then I heard that this was here all year round. So that just made it easy. And this is just a hop, skip, and a jump from where I live. Where my father and I used to go, it was always about the apple cider and stuff like that, you know. And after a while, you know, I moved away from home, I moved further out, so I wasn't so hip to coming downtown to get, you know, apple cider of all things. But, you know, they say you start at a journey, and you sometimes with your parents, you come full circle, and I find myself at this farmer's market now. Oh, I hit most of the major chains. I'll do Giant. I do Wegmans. It's not far from where I work. Safeway. And each one of them, they have certain advantages to certain things. But, like, for instance, today I got some apples. And the nice thing about these apples is I don't have to wash them as long because they're not shiny. You know, you get produce from the supermarket. It's like a fashion show with the produce. You know, it's like America's top vegetable or top apples, and they're all shiny and blushing. Then you got to get them home and dress them down if you want to eat them, you know. So these I just wash, and you just got to eat them quick because they don't last as long as the fancy shiny ones. There's nowhere you can, there are too many places you can get bison, you know. And so that's my red meat of choice these days.
Farmers markets may be a good place to eat bison meat, but can they address food insecurity in Maryland? What's the potential the farmers markets in our region have in feeding people, and what are the limitations? We turn to Ann Palmer, the Eating for the Future program director for the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. She's responsible for directing food and nutrition work at the center. And my producer, Stephanie Mavronis, visited her at her office at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins.
I think farmers markets have been, for a lot of communities, a really critical point in terms of increasing access and also allowing a new market for farmers to sell their products. So it's kind of a win for the local agricultural community, and it's a win for the residents that are availing themselves of those products and regular customers of the market. And I think we've seen just an unprecedented growth in farmers markets since the early 90s. We have close to 8,000 farmers markets nationwide now, and it was like 1,700 in 1994. So that alone just kind of demonstrates the growing interest in these. I do think that, you know, the interest sometimes outpaces what the supply is. It's very difficult for farmers to make a lot of money in farmers' markets. It's weather dependent. It's seasonal. Most markets are not year-round, which means residents have access to those foods during a certain period of time. That probably isn't going to change dramatically given, you know, the weather and ability to grow certain products. Even in the year-round markets, it's difficult. So it is available to people usually one day a week and usually for certain months out of the year. So while it plays an important role, I think we also have to be realistic about how much can it actually complete the picture of food security for people in low-income communities in any community.
I asked Anne about the state of markets in our region. How does the market landscape in Baltimore compare to that of Western Maryland or the Eastern Shore?
I think we have seen a number of smaller farmers markets popping up in the Baltimore area in the last 5 to 7 years. And sometimes they've opened up and had to close because there just wasn't enough business. Some of the markets are quite small. They maybe only have, you know, 5 to 10 vendors. So not all farmers markets are created equal, and you're going to have limited options when you have those smaller markets. We have an interesting conundrum of not enough farmers that are actually, you know, there's more demand for the actual market itself and not enough people to fill that supply. And then once those markets are open, how do you, you know, maintain and sustain that demand? We see things like the doubling of the Baltimore Bucks where people are, you know, able to get up to a certain amount, double their amounts that they're using with their SNAP benefits. So they're actually being able to spend more money on produce and other goods at the market that they wouldn't be able to do. So that is one way to kind of give it a nice boost in the economy and provide an extra incentive for consumers who want to buy fresh produce. Frederick has a decent-sized market. Some of the larger cities, certainly down in Tacoma Park and in the Washington area, those are larger markets as well. But I think in most of the more rural parts of the state, it's harder to support those. But you will see some in most of the city, you know, like Salisbury will have one, and other places like that do have markets, I believe. But they're smaller. They're filling a need, and they're, like I said, they're giving farmers an extra market, another place to sell produce, but it isn't probably the bulk of their sales.
Now, what about the question of access? Are communities experiencing food insecurity being served, or is there a need for better outreach? Anne talked about Baltimore's farmers market under I-83, the Jones Falls Expressway, which she and her team have counted thousands and thousands of people attending on a single Sunday.
If you go to the market under 83, you'll find really a diverse group of people that are attending and purchasing there. And I think the prices are quite competitive. Some markets, I don't think very many in Baltimore City, but some markets do have higher rates and prices are, you know, competitive, if not higher, than the regular supermarket. So that can be disappointing or difficult for people. But in large part, I think it's not that price issue is not the big issue. That market attracts a lot of people. I think they come from word of mouth. It's been around for a long time. Most of the successful markets have that. And I know that when we started with the Baltimore Bucks in Baltimore City 2 years ago, the Department of Social Services sent out a letter to the people who were participating in the SNAP program. And that provided a large boost to the participation in the markets. And, you know, they saw a tremendous spike the weekend after that went in. And so when promotion is done and there's funds available for it, I think it works and it can really bring in people who wouldn't otherwise try the market.
We also talked about the limitations of these markets in addressing the big picture of food insecurity.
We put a lot of energy into this because it is a win for the agricultural sector as well. And so I think if you didn't have that piece there, and that there was that nice marriage of, you know, preserving ag land and providing a really robust, you know, more opportunities for farmers, and you're addressing food access issues for people who want access to healthier foods, you wouldn't see that kind of energy. In terms of the actual picture of what happens and how important it is, in the scheme of things, it still, farmers market sales, SNAP sales at farmers markets are still less than 1% of SNAP sales overall. Mm-hmm. So if you think about, you know, where food stamps are getting spent, they're not getting spent at farmers markets for the most part. They're getting spent in other venues. We would like to see that shift. So you could say that's a win if you got it up to 5% in the next 5 years. That would be a tremendous growth. That means a lot of things would have to be in place. But I think that there is, once people go to the market and they get a sense for the quality of the food that they can get, it is a, you know, markets also provide this you know, sense of community that you don't get when you're going to a regular supermarket typically, or another food retail store. So I think it's reflective of a people's overall need to be more connected with their community and to be able to support local businesses. And I think, you know, when through our community food assessments we've done in several neighborhoods in Baltimore City, we've had this question in there for several years. And we asked them, would you be interested or willing to purchase food that was grown in your neighborhood at a farmer's market? Because there are a number of urban farms that are popping up in Baltimore City. And overwhelmingly, you know, it's like it'll be in the 90s almost every time we talk to people about that, which sort of makes sense. But when you think about it, I mean, these are neighborhoods where people are lower income and they're still struggling financially, but they see that there's a real value in supporting their local economy. And they like the fact that they're putting those dollars into a local farmer's pockets as opposed to, you know, a large supermarket chain. So there's another benefit there that, you know, that kind of circles around, that the dollar gets a little more, it gets sticky, it stays around in the community, and people appreciate that. And they do feel better, I think, about the fact that they're getting their food from somebody they know or they can get to know. We just have to be realistic about where that's going to fit into the overall access picture, because it does, it's an important piece of it, but you don't necessarily want to put a disproportionate amount of energy and, you know, support behind it and think that you're going to solve the food security problem by solving that problem, because I think it's, you know, that it's bigger picture than that, but it is still a really important piece.
If SNAP sales in farmers markets are at only 1% of total SNAP dollars spent, what would it take to increase that dollar amount?
I think we have to do a lot better job promoting. I remember talking to Joyce Smith, who was running the West Baltimore market for a while, and transportation is a big issue for people. Is it possible to provide transportation from key locations like senior buildings or public housing buildings? So Sunday morning, you would have a shuttle bus that would go back and forth on a regular basis, so people would have the opportunity to go and they wouldn't have to be fitting it into their day and make it another obstacle. You know, all those things are a deterrent, you know, for people to be able to actually go and do the purchasing themselves. So part of it is the transportation, part of it is the familiarity that, you know, you're there, you get to experience it, and you start, you know, realizing that there's something there that you want to buy. But the promotion part to me is pretty critical. And then also, I've seen markets where they've done some really nice demonstrations in terms of cooking. What do you do with these things once you've got them? Can you make that connection in the community with the centers that are already doing cooking classes or nutrition courses? Could they somehow be participating in the markets doing demonstrations? And they know there's been some of that done, but not necessarily on a regular basis. And so maybe to have something like that set up on a regular, in some of these markets especially that are maybe struggling and are having a more difficult time. So transportation, I think. More promotion, get the message out there.
I come to the farmers market, depending on the season, but right now mostly to buy meat because it's much cheaper than Whole Foods or places like that, but I can get sustainably raised, not factory farmed kind of meat here. I think about the animals. I've seen way too many things about how animals are treated. I honestly go to Giant for a lot of things if I need something quickly, but I'll try to go to Whole Foods, Trader Joe's. I've been trying to do more planning, which so I can go to the farmers market, because it takes a little bit of planning throughout the week to make sure I, you know, need things by Saturday and you know, don't like get really hungry by Wednesday. So.
Do you use food stamps at the farmer's market?
I did, but then I had this debacle with my food stamps, so now I just use cash.
How did you find the whole process of using the food stamps at the Waverly Farmer's Market?
It was pretty easy. I really liked it. My problem wasn't obviously with the farmer's market. It was more with getting food stamps and like the bureaucracy around all the hoops I had to jump through over and over again. But yeah, it was really easy. You just go to a stand and then give them your card and they swipe it and then they give you tokens. And I think you even get some sort of an incentive. So it ends up being more valuable to shop here with food stamps than with anything else.
That was Farmers Market patron Amy Dewan. How accessible are farmers markets? How easy is it to use SNAP benefits when you're there? And exactly how far those benefits go? Allison Hope Alcon addresses these questions and more in her book, Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. She's professor of sociology at the University of the Pacific. One of the things we've been thinking about in terms of the farmers markets is the, in some ways, is the kind of lack of accessibility that people have, or even knowledge people have of farmers markets, or that they still kind of resonate with a limited but important audience.
I actually think that it's less about resonance or about knowledge than it is about affordability. So one of the farmers markets that I studied is in a very low-income, predominantly African-American neighborhood in Oakland, and they really struggled to get the folks who live right around there to come to the farmers market. And this is a farmers market in a Black community that was particularly aimed at drawing in African-Americans. So they highlighted African-American farmers who have faced really tremendous discrimination from the USDA historically. And they brought Black farmers in and kind of talked about that kind of education. Most of the other kinds of vendors, people who sold jams and soaps and other kind of related things, were African-American from East and West Oakland, good Black parts of Oakland. They really tried to spin the market as a Black space, not an exclusively Black space, but a space that was really created by and for African-Americans. So they had the cultural resonance down. They were in the neighborhood where African-Americans lived. But the problem when I did focus groups with folks who lived right around the neighborhood and didn't shop there was that it was more expensive than going to a grocery store and buying processed foods that are subsidized through all kinds of government programs to be artificially cheap.
That's huge. I mean, the folks were using SNAP. They were using people who needed it and were qualified for it. They could use SNAP at the farmer's market.
Yeah, they could. Their SNAP didn't go as far. SNAP gives you a meager amount to live on, right? If you're really dependent on food stamps, it's really hard to get by on your month's worth of food. And I think we've seen all these like food stamp challenges and things. You know, Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, was doing one recently. All kinds of high profile people have done it. And the bottom line from all these publicity is that it's really hard to get by on the amount of money that SNAP gives you to purchase food for the month, right? So people who have SNAP, even if they could use it at the farmer's market, they want to use it at the place where they can get the most food for it. And that's not the farmer's market. In Michigan, there's a program called Double Bucks, where if you use your SNAP at farmer's markets, and I think some health food stores as well, then it goes twice as far. And that, of all the programs I know of, has had the most success in getting low-income people to take advantage of farmer's markets. You know, we tend to think that the problem is like, you know, oh, there's something wrong with these people. They don't like farmers markets, or they don't want fresh produce, or they don't know about it, or they don't know how to cook. But actually, all of those assumptions aren't true. From what I found, the most fundamental thing is that they're actually quite savvy about how to buy food. And they know that their priority needs to be getting enough food for their money to be able to feed their families. And so they go to the place where that is most easily done. And that's not the farmers market.
So does that mean, that from your analysis, that farmers markets are only tenable for communities of means, that they can't, won't, don't work in working class and poor working class communities?
I think particularly the ones that are highlighting organic food, that tends to be more true. If you go to places like, and I'm sorry that this is so California biased, because I'm sure you have your Baltimore area equivalent. But if you go to places like where I teach in Stockton, which is a really poor city, it's, you know, up there in the top five foreclosure cities in the country and has tremendous problems, their farmers market, which is mostly immigrant Southeast Asian farmers, draws in low-income people. You know, they have a kind of bougier farmers market where, like, faculty at my school who live in the area shop and things like that, but they have farmers markets that are really, really inexpensive, and then they draw in low-income people. And particularly when they're culturally matched, right, to the Southeast Asian farmers. Stockton has a really large Southeast Asian community. There are particular kinds of foods that both of those groups are growing and looking for that maybe are not typical at a farmer's market in Berkeley, where I live. You know, and that seems to work really well. But the food is really inexpensive.
Coming rounding back to what you just said, the farmers that worked at the West Oakland farmer's mm-hmm. market, were the African-American farmers urban farmers, suburban farmers, or rural farmers?
Main farmers were both rural. One came from outside of Fresno, which is about 2.5 hours away. And the other one came from a small town called Livingston, which is about 1.5 hours away. And they were the two main farmers. And they were both African-American. They were joined for most of the duration of the market by two Latino growers who were from like the Watsonville area, so also about 2 hours away, rural. These are big farming communities, right? The two Black farmers were both from the Central Valley, which is, you know, the kind of breadbasket of America. And then the two Latino growers were both from Watsonville, which is like the center of strawberry production in California. There was an urban farm and school garden project that would come and sell, like, star core flowers. But the mission was to support commercial farmers of color. And so the urban programs that were mostly grant funded didn't want to compete with the folks who were business, who were doing sustainable food businesses. And so they kind of filled in what wasn't already there.
When you think about transforming the food system, when you think about how people get access to food, especially in working class and poor working class communities, communities that we're calling food deserts, communities that they're like, let's say in Maryland, where we're broadcasting from, 17% of Marylanders in one of the richest states in the nation feel food insecure. From the work you've been doing, you can extrapolate out of the Bay Area. What role do farmers markets play? I mean, is it just a role of the elite, or is it something that can actually function as a way to distribute and get food to everyone?
I don't think it has to be limited to elites. I think when farmers markets, and, you know, there was a study that came out, before I started doing my research, called Hot Peppers and Parking Lot Peaches, and it was done by, I think it was the UCD, the Small Farm Center. It talks about how if you want to put a farmers market in a low-income neighborhood, the best move economically is to put it on kind of the border between the low-income neighborhood and a middle-income neighborhood, so you had more middle-income shoppers who could kind of be the regulars and sustain the market, and then low-income people would have access to it when and if it suited their needs. Then the other thing farmers markets really do is educate people. They talk about where food comes from, what the obstacles to growing healthy and sustainable food are, what's not just the, like, climactic or ecological obstacles, but also the political obstacles. And I think, you know, if we're really going to change the food system, we have to stop thinking that we can just kind of create a bunch of alternatives and that the mainstream food system or the industrial food system is somehow going to collapse because these alternatives are so wonderful. Right? We need to use these alternatives as a place to do the kind of political education that's necessary to build the kind of people power that can actually affect and constrain and eventually transform the industrial food system. So I mentioned food subsidies a couple minutes ago. We need to think about what the world would look, what the food system would look like if we subsidize ecological production, if we subsidize workers' rights, right? If we subsidize selling in low-income areas to make it, which is what they do in Brazil, where they, you know, farmers who sell in the lowest income areas get a subsidy. In Belo Horizonte in Brazil is one city that's kind of pioneered that. So we need to really think politically and not just think about kind of how to have these amazing, enriching experiences around food, but also to think about what we do with those experiences in order to make them be potentially accessible for a much wider range of people, and then also so that the environmental benefits and the social benefits of sustainable food systems can actually be widely felt and widely shared, right? Just having healthy soil on a couple of organic farms in some places is great, but constraining the amount of pesticides used by the industrial food system so that all of the spaces of agriculture in this country are healthier and have richer soil and don't run off into water is a much bigger deal.
It is. It's a huge question, and I think one that everybody's trying to wrestle with. How do we get to a point where that kind of work can take place? But people of means have made that decision. I mean, they go to Whole Foods, they go to their farmers markets, they can kind of make that decision with their pocketbooks because they have the pocketbooks with which to make those decisions. You know, when you write in your book about the compatibility between sustainability and justice, you know, the farmers markets are not inherent, is one of the things you said in your book. And I think that's very real. Are there places where it's working? Are there places where this kind of change in distribution, change in how people access food is actually taking place?
You know, I mentioned the double bus example from Michigan. I think that's a real kind of groundbreaking example, you know. But it does take some government support. You know, when you look at pretty much every major city, there are urban farms, there are farmers markets kind of popping up in low-income areas. And then there's political work being done, right? There's organizations like Live Real that organizes youth of color from all across the country to get political about food system stuff.
Now, we have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear more from Allison Hope Alcon, more voices from our farmers' markets, and hear an African-American and Jewish Passover recipe from culinary historian Michael Twitty. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com.
Carl Stokes, City Councilman, 12th District, Baltimore City. Congratulations to Mark on this great anniversary. 20 years on the air, that's fantastic. You're so good at bringing people together and having them share their life and their experiences with the greater community. We've been friends for such a long time. I just think about the early fight that you were a part of, the early struggles in civil rights in Baltimore, people's rights in Baltimore City, and how you've continued to be very much a part of that.
Join the Center for Emerging Media Board as they honor Mark Steiner for his 20 years on the air and 50 years working for justice. April 6th at AVAM. More information at steinershow.org/2050. Champion sponsors, the Osprey Foundation and Clean Cuts, Cerebral Lounge, media partners, the Baltimore Business Journal, and WEAA-FM.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and this is Soundbites. Today on our show, we're discussing farmers markets in Maryland and beyond. What kind of potential do they hold in feeding people in our state? What are their limitations? Before we went to break, we heard about farmers markets accepting SNAP benefits. Now we turn to Mark Ray, who's president of Baltimore's 32nd Street Farmers Market Board, about how and why his farmers market started to accept SNAP benefits.
We had wanted to start it because there were a number of customers who were in the SNAP program who asked why didn't we take them, why couldn't we take them. We said it was too expensive. And then just at that time, a group called Maryland Hunger Solutions asked us if we would like to be part of a pilot program to start SNAP transactions in the market, because they said they would get us some funding to help get us started. And we said, we've been waiting for this. Thank you. Yes, we'll take it. It keeps growing. It's very successful because we're up to, we started where it was like bringing in about, first year brought in about $20,000 to our vendors. Next year, $30,000. We're almost to $50,000 this year. So it has steadily increased. We have a wireless machine that automatically transfers a customer's funds to our bank account. And because we can't give cash at an ATM, we have a token system. Are there tokens that are money good in this market? A person swipes a card, asks for, let's say, $25, and then we will, once that transaction goes through, we give them the tokens. They can spend those tokens anywhere. All vendors take them. It costs between $2,500 and $3,000 to start up. That's why we hadn't done it previously. And the machine, wireless machine, operates kind of like a cell phone, where it's like $50 a month charge plus every transaction they charge us for. So it does cost to keep it, but we set up a system so that the transaction fees that debit card customers pay basically finance the program once we got it started. But Maryland Hunger Solutions gave us the money up front for the wireless machine and so forth, and the cost of getting the tokens made. It's an incentive program to get, and it's been very successful at our market, to get SNAP customers fresh produce and good, wholesome foods rather than junk food, snacks, that kind of thing. And Maryland Hunger Solutions has worked with a group called Wholesome Wave in the area, and they get us grant money. They got us a slightly over $10,000, for instance, last year, so that we could offer Independence Car customers the option of coming. If you come to the market, you'll get with the first of the funding we had, we matched up to the first $10. Of their purchases. They got 10 extra dollars to spend in the market. When that ran a little bit lower, then we gave $5 out. And we're, so it's, it's been a great help for them, and it brings more and more customers to the market to use the program.
How many people a week do you think use their independence card here?
It varies according to the time of the month. Uh-huh. The first and the last weeks of the month are relatively light because money hasn't been put on the cards. We usually get about, I would say, 25 to maybe 30 on those days. But by the middle of the month, days like today, we get between 50 and 80 transactions.
And how, like on average, how much money would you say are people taking out each time? Like, is there a rough average that you would say most people take out to shop at the market?
It really varies wildly. We now have Independence Card customers who take out $100, who get most of their fresh food here. So we've had like three or four $100 EBT today, and we've also had $10 ones. You know, it varies tremendously. I'd say between $10 and $100.
Now we return to our conversation with Allison Hope Alcon, author of Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy, and professor of sociology at the University of the Pacific. Yeah, I mean, I'm very curious about how you see the failure of this market in Oakland and the thriving nature of the market in Berkeley, how that played itself out. I mean, I look at certain urban areas, whether it's Detroit or Baltimore or even Oakland, other places where there's vast acreage of land that's just there from torn down buildings, land that's not being used. Some people have made the argument that we need to maybe rethink what urban agriculture could look like and how that can be grown by people who live there and distributed as well, and people making a living at it. I mean, is that part of the discussion, you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I think Detroit is really the model to look to there. Oakland doesn't have the kind of open fields of land that Detroit does. Not only is there not the actual land, but California real estate is so expensive that even if you can squat on it, the chances are that it'll get taken and sold at some point. So I don't know that it has the same potential for urban agriculture, not necessarily spatially, but economically, that a place like Detroit might. But I do think, you know, there's for people who want to go into food system businesses, there are some opportunities for low-income people to do that work for themselves. And I know People's Grocery in Oakland, for example, has a kind of entrepreneurship support model for people who want to start businesses around sustainable food. And I think that's really wonderful. On the other hand, farming is not a well-paid occupation. The idea that we're going to take low-income people in the inner cities and we're going to teach them to pull them up by their bootstraps and start successful businesses by becoming farm workers is crazy. We need to think about how the system in which who decides what labor is worth and what food is worth, how do those rules get made, and how can we change them so that farming becomes a potentially lucrative career and so that your ability to consume healthy food doesn't necessarily have to be tied to your ability to pay for it, right? The idea that health should be a commodity that you pay for is an essentially unjust proposition.
So I'm curious where you think this the next phase of this goes.
I think we need to look beyond the project level and start scaling up, right? There is no one cause that the folks who are interested in sustainable and local food are rallying around that we can think about how do we legislate it. We need to think beyond just, I'm going to pop up a farmer's market here and that's going to solve things, because we can't just solve the problem by looking at the consequences, right? The actual causes of food injustice in our country are not local. They're bigger and more national level, and so we need to think about how we change the playing field on which these local effects play out. Farmers markets are the fastest growing sector of the U.S. food economy. So many people are interested in health and access and all these questions. That's really encouraging.
This has been fascinating. I look forward to bringing you back on here as soon as we can on Soundbites. Allison Hope Alcon, her latest book is called Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. Allison, thank you so much for joining us on Soundbites.
Thanks for having me.
SNAP benefits are not the only way people are addressing food insecurity at farmers markets. My producers, Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis, caught up with Arthur Morgan at the 32nd Street Farmers Market. He's an OSI Baltimore Fellow and started Gather Baltimore, a volunteer-based program that collects and gleans fresh produce donated by farmers markets and farms for distribution in Baltimore through local hospitals, meal programs, and faith communities.
What is Gather Baltimore?
Gaining access to healthy eating resources. We're basically trying to capture every single bit of, you wouldn't call it food waste, but excess food, whether it's from farmers markets, farm stands, actually going out to fields and gleaning excess produce, capturing excess food from central distributor as far as Coastal Sunbelt, Jessup, also Whole Foods, Walmart, Costco, any food source where there's excess. And we're trying to get that food to people who are challenged, whether it's financially or either access to healthy food. And we're finding that a lot of different people just don't have access to healthy food.
And how do you go about doing that?
We have stands at the farmers markets, so we see how much excess food there is there after the markets, and then we talk to the farmers, and the farmers let us know that there's a lot more food that's actually back at the farm. It's not even being harvested or going anywhere. By also talking to the grocery stores, I mean, you know, every grocery store wants that product to look as nice as it can, so they're just constantly picking through and picking things out that, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, that food still has use, and there's plenty of people who need and could use that food. Our main focus right now is getting that food from being thrown away or wasted and getting it to people who actually could use it.
How do you distribute it?
Basically, we have different days where we're gathering and distributing, going to different places like Movable Feast, Franciscan Center, Helping Up Mission, Our Daily Bread. We've set up a farm stand in the Oliver neighborhood, working with a group called the Sixth Branch. We're looking to start farm stands in, basically they call them food deserts, but just areas that don't have access. And we will take our refrigeration truck and go get a load of food, whether it's from a store or a farm, and then go right into the neighborhood and set up a stand and start handing out food.
How much food would you say you're collecting on like a weekly basis?
It just varies. You're talking about thousands and thousands of pounds that we get from Jessup. When we're out in the fields gleaning, you're talking 3,000 to 5,000 pounds in a couple of hours. Basically, we'll fill our truck up in a couple of hours, and we're just scratching the surface, basically. I mean, what is there? If I had 100 people every day, I could go to a different farm every day of the week and get the food. And it's just a matter of getting it to the right people who can use it, though, and also people who know what to do with the food. You know, a lot of people have issues understanding how to prepare the food or what they can do with the food. They're just not used to eating that type of food.
Now, you were explaining why there's so much excess at grocery stores. Why is there so much excess food that's not being harvested at farms?
Every farmer, you know, there's so many variables, whether it's Mother Nature or just you always want to have products. So a farmer's going to overplant, and you never know how the market's going to be. You know, some years are really, really good, and some years are off. A farmer knows that it's easier to plant large amounts of food and at a different time they stagger. So you get into one field where there's just lots and lots of food, but after you've kind of picked through that field, it's easier to go to the next field that is just full of food than it is to take more time and to pick through where it's already been picked over. So a farmer would rather us come in and say, hey, you know, go get into that field that we've already picked through. There's still plenty there. We're going to focus our energy on getting into the field where it's easier to, you know, to pick. Basically cost. I mean, you're looking at labor cost and things like that. And it just makes more sense.
What kinds of produce are you generally getting?
Everything. Everything. I mean, we'll be in the field, in a couple of weeks. As soon as the weather breaks, we'll start with spinach and everything that's spring related. And then we'll get into summer crops and fall crops. I mean, we follow the seasons, and we work right with the farmers. I mean, I was just speaking to the farmers this morning, and they're like, hey, about 4 more weeks, get ready.
What's your process at the farmer's market?
Basically, what we do is at each farm stand, we'll go to that stand and put out some containers. We'll let the farmers know that anything that they don't have use for or want to donate, they can put in the containers. Or we also let people know who are shopping at markets. Hey, you can purchase stuff and actually donate it to Gather Baltimore. And then usually we have groups of volunteers that will come with us and help us gather. We'll go to every single stand, whether it's putting in bags, putting in containers. Sometimes, like I said, we'll go, instead of going to the farmer's market, we'll just go straight to the fields and start gleaning. And the farmer would rather his food go somewhere. I mean, it's a lot of work to farm that food. So, and I'm trying to work on a way so that farmer could actually get some type of compensation.
So where do you want, like within the next year, where do you hope to see this project?
Well, the biggest thing right now, we're, I think that I need to have a facility where I have more refrigeration because I can always be gathering food. And sometimes you have barriers as far as actually when I get the food, but I need a spot where I can put it and store it, and then other places could actually come and pick it up there, or I could separate it and be able to distribute it differently that way instead of just constantly having to go straight from the truck to another spot, because different organizations basically just need different types of foods. Like yesterday I was at Jessup, you know, and I got 7,000 pounds of potatoes in a matter of, you know, an hour. And, you know, some people know what to do with that, and some people, they're not going to mess with it. And as the seasons change, you just are, you know, dealing with different products. But we're definitely looking for volunteers. I mean, that is our main thing that keeps us going is just manpower. So whether it's volunteer groups, service groups, people who just want to come out and do something, that's a big part of what keeps us going.
How do people get involved?
Facebook, Gather Baltimore. And also Hamilton Crop Circle. Both organizations have Facebook pages. It's just a lot easier that way for us to post when we're going to have volunteer days and events. You know, healthy food makes a big difference. And it's the small things that seem to really, you know, you just kind of have to chip away. So people working together out in the field, volunteering. Sometimes you have people who are from a different area, and then you have people who in Oliver who are coming to work together. And when those people meet, they kind of get to know what's going on and where the food's going. So, you know, it's not about just giving and taking. It's, you know, people need to understand what's going on. So.
Now, healthy food isn't the only reason people go to farmers markets. Liz Bolton explains why she shops there.
It's really interesting. I shop at the farmers market because I get to know people and I get to be a part of a community. Before I lived in Baltimore, I lived in Philadelphia, and I was part of the Weaver's Way Co-op. And it felt like food and shopping was just a part of community life and weekly and daily life. And that's what Waverly Market is like for me and for my family. We come here, we meet people. My son sees me talking to someone I know for too long, he gets cranky. But that really becomes part of our routine.
And where else do you shop for food?
Let's see. I've been going to the same Giant on York Road for the 13 years that I lived in Baltimore, and that's kind of similar. There are folks who work there, who've worked there the whole time I've lived in Baltimore, and that makes it also part of the community life and routines.
And how far is that from your house?
About a mile and a half, 2 miles. You know, after 13 years in Baltimore, I still struggle with the need to take trips for certain things, even though I have a car and I can get to any corner of the city. I still want to sort of calculate, is it worth it? Do I need to get in the car to go to such and such a place? Or if I take a bike here to the market, you know, how much can I get? How much is it worth for us and our time as a family, you know, to take certain trips to get food? I have a comfortable vantage point, yet it's still really a calculus for me.
What do you get at the farmer's market that you don't get at the Giant?
I would say really specifically protein sources. When my budget will allow, I prefer to get protein stuff here because I know it's safer and healthier. It feels a little odd because sometimes when my budget doesn't allow, I get those same things at supermarkets, and I just try to find a balance between doing what I know is healthiest and best for my family and what I can afford.
How much do you spend a month for your family on food?
Gosh, that's a really good question. Well, probably $800 a month. Can I add one more thing about community gardens?
Yeah.
That has been really transformative for me and my family. My community has a garden. It's completely cooperative. So we just pay $20 a year and do all the work, and whoever can show up on a Sunday gets a share. And that really makes a difference in my consciousness about what I eat and what it takes to have a low carbon imprint on your tomatoes because they come from down the street. Really transforms what you're willing to buy in the supermarket.
And where do you live, and where's the garden?
The garden is just behind the Popeyes on York Road. I live in Radnor Winston, which is part of Govanstown neighborhood.
We're about to hear another one of our incredible recipes here on Soundbites. We are joined by Michael Twitty, who's a culinary historian, a Hebrew school teacher, a man who brings his African and Hebrew cultures together in more unique ways than anybody that I know. And Michael Twitty, welcome. Good to have you with us again.
Hey, always a pleasure.
So Passover is upon us.
Yep.
One of the most important holidays in the Jewish world, commemorating the liberation of Jews from Egypt and the trek through the desert and Exodus and Moses and whether they actually left Egypt or not, who cares? It's the holiday that is celebrated to talk about many other deep things.
Yeah.
So talk to us about this holiday for you and what are you going to bring to the table, literally and figuratively?
Well, Passover is my favorite holiday. It's my favorite holiday, period. I think it's my favorite holiday because the dialogue at the table. If you're at the right Seder, I mean, if you're at the little kid's Seder, you know, it's going to last an hour, you need to eat, you're going to go home.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're at the Seders that I go to that start, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock at night and last until 2, 3 in the morning, 80% of that time is spent on dialogue talking about what does it mean to be free? What does it mean to not have constraints? What does it mean to not be conceited? What does it not mean to be sour? You know, we get rid of the matzah, we get rid of the chametz, which is the leaven, the sour part of our identities, the sour part of our lives, in exchange for matzah, this, you know, hardtack of the desert. And that's incredible. You know, that's an incredible thought. You know, you get rid of freedom means going back to the simplest, most basic, and often uncomfortable. And believe me, if you've eaten, you know, the full 8 days of matzah, you know the meaning of uncomfortable. You know.
I like matzah.
Matzah is great the first 2 days. I mean, I actually avoid it. I don't eat matzah in any form for the majority of the year, Mark. I'm telling you, I avoid it like the plague. Only because you're supposed to, like, the first time you taste the matzah on Passover, it's supposed to be a novel experience. So I don't really do, like, matzah as a, you know, soup cracker or anything like that. And the first 2 days is fantastic. After that, I really could leave it alone. But speaking of matzah, I have 2 Seder plates I have around during the Passover season. Whether I go to someone's house, I bring it. If it's my house, which is not often, I'll have these 2 Seder plates out. So, you know, typical, you know, Passover symbols are the egg, which symbolizes life and spring and all that kind of good stuff and cycles, and also the temple sacrifices. And then there's the matzah, of course, which symbolizes journey from slavery to freedom. And, you know, the myth about not having enough time. Well, guess what, Mark? I'm a culinary historian. Poor people didn't have leavened bread.
Mm-hmm.
This is called lechem oni, which means the bread of the poor, the bread of affliction for a reason. So it's not supposed to be leavened. So the idea here is that time is the most important resource. That's where our richness comes from, having the time to do these things, that time to experience life. There's this ruah, which is the lamb's bone, symbolizes the sacrifices again. And then there's the hazeret, which is horseradish, you know, your horseradish. And sometimes maror is the horseradish, too, but some people do one's romaine lettuce and one's horseradish, whatever they want to do. Haroset is the apples and the nuts and the fruit. I can't eat nuts anymore, but that's okay. It's a sweet date or apple mixture, depending on where you come from in the Jewish world. And, of course, is the karpas, which is the spring vegetable. So in my tradition, my African-American Jewish mix-up, the karpas is not just the parsley or the celery or the potato, because, you know, I bet you your folks, Mark, back in Eastern Europe used potato.
Yeah.
And you know why? Because there was no parsley growing in Poland at this time of the year. That's why. They didn't have anything else. But my African-American karpas, because I'm a slavery interpreter, and I work a lot with the culinary history of slavery, is the sweet potato. And I use that to stand in the place the yams of our ancestors when they were in West Africa. The egg was a sacrifice given to Almighty God in Ghana. And it symbolizes that we may be, you know, afflicted by things, but we get harder, we get stronger. It's like the egg when it hard boils. The haroset for me is not the apples and wine and nuts. It's molasses and peanuts, or molasses and pecan. And that symbolizes both the sweetness and the horror of living in the South. Because those two extremes are what created the beautiful blues, the beautiful food culture, the beautiful spiritual culture that the Black Southerner gave as a gift to the world, not just America. And for the maror, I use collard greens.
Hmm.
I mean, you can't beat that. I mean, that's the Bible and the bitterness of slavery all in one symbol. The hazeret, instead of horseradish, is the hot red pepper. Because you know you can't have black food without hot pepper. But you also can't have life without spice.
Uh-huh.
And for the lamb's bone, I use the chicken bone. And that's self-explanatory. If you don't know what I mean, it's like Louis Armstrong. If you don't know what I mean, then you got to need to go get a history lesson. And then the matzah is the hoe cake. The white. Now I know Ashkenazi don't do corn and rice on Pesach, but I follow Sephardic customs, so I do. And that white cornmeal hoe cake is our heart attack of slavery. So these two symbols side by side mean a lot to me.
Give us your what Passover recipe you bring to the table today.
Well, I'm gonna quickly go over a recipe I have for West African brisket. So this recipe is pretty much the standard. Forgive me, vegans and vegetarians. Just the standard Passover delicacy is the brisket. That's the highlight of the evening after you've had all this wine and matzah and, you know, you snacked on parsley. And then you roll something substantial. So this brisket is based on, you know, both Jewish and West African foodways. So very quickly, you need a teaspoon of ginger, a tablespoon of paprika, black pepper, a teaspoon of coarse black pepper, a teaspoon of cinnamon, a teaspoon of chili powder, a teaspoon of cayenne pepper, a tablespoon of kosher salt. Now, if you use a kosher brisket, you probably don't need that much kosher salt, to be honest with you, because they're already, you know, salted and then soaked. So there's probably a lot of sodium in there already. You need a 5-pound brisket. You need 4 cloves of garlic that have been peeled and minced. You need 4 tablespoons of olive oil. You need 3 onions that have been peeled and diced. You need 3 bell peppers, green, red, and yellow. You know, we got to have those colors, man. You got to have that color. The black, the red, the green, right? And the yellow if you're Jamaican. And then you have, of course, the diced tomatoes. Make sure they're kosher for Passover. Tablespoon or 2 of brown sugar. A teaspoon of prepared horseradish or more, you know, depending on how you like it. 2 cups of chicken, beef, or vegetable stock. Kosher for Passover once again. 2 bay leaves, a sprig of thyme, 2 large red onions. So basically, you take all those spices and you rub it into the meat and the garlic and all of it, and you just let it sit as long as it can, 4 hours, overnight, whatever you got. And then you take 2 teaspoons of that spice mixture and save it for the vegetables. What do you do with every brisket? You put the oil in the pan, you sear it. You sear it on both sides, you remove it from the Dutch oven, you set it aside. You take your onions, your bell peppers, your tomatoes, everything. You saute the onions till they're translucent. Then you add your tomatoes and bell pepper, and you basically just stew it up for 5 minutes. You add the sugar, the stock, the horseradish, the bay leaf, the thyme, and then you pour that out. Just put it in the bowl. You place the onions at the bottom of the Dutch oven and put a little more olive oil on top of that. Put the brisket on top of that and take everything else. Put that on top of that. Cover it. Put it in a 350-degree oven for 3.5 hours until the brisket is fork tender. And then never just eat a brisket out the pot. You know this. This is a cardinal rule. You take it out. You let it cool. Let it come down to room temperature. When you refrigerate it, do your food safety rules. And then you basically let it chill, and then you can remove the excess fat. Then you slice it against the grain, always against the grain. And then you heat that sauce up. You put your brisket in another kind of pan or container. You pour the sauce on top of it. You warm it up, and bam. You got a slam and seder dish.
My man, Michael Twitty, thank you so much, and happy Pesach to you.
Thank you. Chag Sameach v'kasher.
I want to thank all of our guests today, Michael Twitty, Ann Palmer, Allison Hope Alcon, Guy Alston, Mark Ray, Amy Dewan, Arthur Morgan, and Liz Bolton. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews and Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. For the 5th year in a row, Maryland's public schools have been named number 1 in the country by Education Week magazine. Visit MarylandEducators.org to explore what it means to invest in our students, school construction, and safety, and the educators' programs and services that make our schools a national leader. That's MarylandEducators.org.